I'm Tracy Sable. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, overnight strike. New developments in the war between Israel and Hamas as another ground offensive appears likely. Headed for Jamaica. Record-setting Hurricane Beryl rips through open waters and is on course for a major Caribbean island. Heartbeat law. What church leaders in Iowa are saying about a recent ruling by the state Supreme Court. And internet icon. A closer look at the life of Blessed Carlo Acutis, set to be canonized by the Vatican. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us. Our top story tonight, between Israeli bombardments and new evacuation orders, the Gaza Strip may be roughly 140 square miles, yet according to the International Committee of the Red Cross, there is, quote, no safe place. Today, a missile strike hit a home in Khan Yunis, killing at least six people. It reportedly hit an area where the Israeli military ordered its evacuation just one day earlier. The United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees estimates that 250,000 people are in that evacuation zone. Well, a group dedicated to helping vulnerable people around the world is set to deliver food and medical supplies to Gaza. Jason Jones, founder and president of the Vulnerable People Project, says his group has been given permission to deliver up to 10 truckloads worth of food and supplies into Gaza each month. The aid primarily will go to the Christian communities. And Jason Jones joins us now. He is the founder and president of the Vulnerable People Project. Jason, welcome back. Always good to see you. So I know VPP has been helping needy people, even making deliveries in some of the most dangerous areas on earth. But now you're going into Gaza. Why do you feel that's important to help people there? And what sort of aid will you be delivering?
Well, Tracy, thank you for having me on it. Well, there was a religious community that we served in Ukraine during the war, and that same religious community is in Gaza. So when the war, immediately when the war started, the Vulnerable People Project was in communication and began working to deliver aid and support. We paid for eye surgeries. We've evacuated pregnant mothers. But now with the IDF has completely cut the north off from the south, and there's a famine looming in the north. So I flew to the Middle East. I'm in Cairo right now, and we're now staging our trucks in southern Gaza, and we hope to tomorrow begin delivering our trucks into the north to specifically and directly serve the Christian communities in Gaza.
And Jason, what do you see as the biggest needs in Gaza right now, and what areas are being impacted the most?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that there's been a lot of famine denying that there's a famine in Gaza, but Gaza has been completely divided between the north and the south by the Israeli Defense Force. 100% of the Christians and all of the churches are in the north, and that is where the famine is looming. And so while there are 15,000 confirmed children that have been killed in this war, another 20,000 that are missing, and so that's a great concern. We want a ceasefire, but as long as this war continues to rage in the north, because the north has been cut off from all deliveries, the greatest threat is famine.
And what else would you like people to know about the situation there in Gaza?
Well, I think it's important to recognize the beauty and dignity of the Christians in Gaza. This is a church that goes back to St. James. These are the descendants of the apostles' families. The apostles of these are the descendants of the very first Christians. And so as a Catholic, you know, you look in Paul's letters. The majority of his letters, when Paul exhorts us to pray and fast, it's for the persecuted church. And so I would ask that all Christians pray for the people of Gaza and pray for the Christian communities of Gaza.
All right, Jason, we're going to leave right there. Thank you so much for coming on today, and thank you for what you do. We appreciate it. God bless.
Thank you.
All right, now to the Caribbean, where a hurricane warning is in effect for Jamaica as a now Category 4 storm rips through the open waters. Currently downgraded to a Cat 4, Hurricane Beryl was the earliest Category 5 storm to ever form in the Atlantic. Beryl has already hit St. Vincent as well as Barbados. The hurricane is expected to bring life-threatening winds and storm surge to Jamaica, where officials have warned locals to prepare for evacuation. Earlier today, the storm had top winds of 160 miles per hour. And for more, let's go to Dr. Jill Trepanier, chair of Louisiana State University's Department of Oceanography and Coastal Sciences. She is also an expert on extreme climate and weather phenomena, including hurricanes. Dr. Trepanier, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it. So what does the latest advisory say about Hurricane Beryl right now?
Well, right now, it is downgraded to a Category 4, like you said, but only just barely. And so it still has an incredible force that it's moving through open water toward Jamaica. So the latest is it is weakening. They are expecting it to continue to weaken just slightly as it approaches the coastline of Jamaica, but it will likely hit as a major hurricane in the early hours of Wednesday morning. The storm, thankfully, is moving quickly, so it has forward trajectory that is getting it away from Jamaica relatively quickly compared to storms that may stall in a region. So thankfully, it will move beyond relatively fast. And the thought is that it will hit the Yucatan at a minor category strength, one or two, as it downgrades further. And typically when storms interact with the plateau, the highland area of the Yucatan and that land interaction, they continue to decay even more. So the thoughts are it will weaken as it moves out into the Bay of Campeche. I think at that point is when we really need to watch for it to see if it will have any additional space before landfall again to intensify before making landfall a second time or third, I suppose.
Yeah, and when it does make landfall, I mean, what should folks prepare for?
Any storm like this, immediately at a coastline, you have to think about storm surge, which is that large rise in water as a storm approaches the coastline. That's an immediate coastal threat. But then on top of that, you have waves, and the heights of those can vary drastically depending on where you are along the coastline. But at a Category 4 strength, it will be a large inundation no matter where you are in that space. I think then once you're a little further inland or maybe even a higher elevation, there's that severe wind threat. Most people don't quite recognize the level of severity of 150 miles per hour or even 130 miles per hour. Even though the storm is weakening, that's still an incredible wind intensity that can easily take off the rooftops of buildings and you know, influence structures in negative ways. So I think the big threats are those. And then if you do live in a place where you might be at the bottom of a river system, or you might be near a low land area around higher plateau regions, you might see additional flooding from rainfall. The storm, thankfully, like I said, it's moving quickly. So ideally the rain will it will be heavy when it happens, but then it will be over relatively quickly. That's the hope. But if you are in a place that's prone to flooding due to rainfall, not from coastal flooding, that's something you should be considering as well.
We have about 20 seconds left, but I really want to ask you this question really quickly about timing. Is it rare to see a hurricane of this magnitude so early in the season?
It is. Typically, eastern edges of ocean basins have a little bit of cool water this early in the season. But as we all know, the Atlantic has been exceptionally hot early in the year. And so I think that's part of why we saw such an early eastern Atlantic basin storm form at this level.
All right. We're going to leave right there. Thank you so much for weighing in, Dr. Trepanier. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
All the sentencing for former President Donald Trump in his hush money case in New York is postponed until at least September. The delay comes as the judge considers the possible impact of yesterday's Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity. Trump had been scheduled to be sentenced July 11th after being found guilty of 34 counts. The GOP presumptive presidential candidate has denied any wrongdoing. Our President Joe Biden addressed excessive heat in the workplace today, but he is still feeling the heat after his shaky debate performance last Thursday that left many wondering whether he should keep running. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
Tracy, good evening to you. I was in that briefing room today, and usually the questions are on several different topics. Not today. Instead, all the questions were, or virtually, I should say, all the questions were focused on one thing, the president's debate performance last week.
President Joe Biden delivers remarks at the D.C. Emergency Operations Center.
Summer has just started. Already Tens of millions of Americans are under heat warnings from record-shattering temperatures.
Today, the Biden administration proposing a new rule that, if finalized, would protect an estimated 36 million U.S. workers from injuries related to heat exposure on the job, establishing the first major federal safety standard of its kind.
This includes things like developing response plans to heat illness, training employees and supervisors, implementing rest breaks, access to shade and water.
Meanwhile, in the White House press briefing room, things getting hot as well, as people raise more questions about the president's, at times, incoherent performance on the debate stage.
It was a bad night. That's what we believe it to be. We're not taking away what people saw. We're just not. That is, want to be very clear about that.
As for the president's immediate future,
we want to turn the page on this, and we want to turn the page for the American people as well.
Just last night, the president slammed the U.S. Supreme Court after the high court ended its term by ruling that former presidents have broad immunity from prosecution, a decision that almost certainly means former President Donald Trump won't stand trial again before the November election.
This decision today has continued the court's attack in recent years on a wide range of long-established legal principles in our nation, from gutting voting rights and civil rights to taking away a woman's right to choose, to today's decision that undermines the rule of law of this nation.
Walking away, he took no questions.
Now, late today, President Biden took part in a campaign fundraiser in nearby Virginia. Speaking of campaigns, his reelection campaign and the DNC report raising $264 million in the second quarter this year. The Trump campaign outdoing that with a number of $331 million for the quarter. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
Now, the Biden administration says emergency room doctors must perform emergency abortions when necessary. This follows the Supreme Court's ruling last week on emergency abortions in Idaho. In a letter to doctor and hospital associations, the White House says in part, quote, "No pregnant woman or her family should have to even begin to worry that she could be denied the treatment she needs to stabilize her emergency medical condition in the emergency room." On the first, House Democrat joins the list of those calling for President Biden to withdraw from the 2024 election. In a statement, longtime Texas lawmaker Lloyd Doggett says, "My decision to make these strong reservations public is not done lightly, nor does it in any way diminish my respect for all that President Biden has achieved, recognizing that, unlike Trump, President Biden's first commitment has always been to our country, not himself. I'm hopeful that he will make the painful and difficult decision to withdraw." A Congress is on recess this week, but some lawmakers are already digging in over how much money the federal government should spend next year, while others say the current top-line number isn't enough. The battle is sure to heat up as the 2024 election is only a few months away. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales reports. Eric.
Oh, good evening, Tracy. Let's give our viewers a little background. Now, this fight over government funding actually started last year when Congress passed a deal called the Fiscal Responsibility Act. It was negotiated by then House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and President Joe Biden. It raised the debt ceiling and put a spending cap on government funding spending. But you may recall that that agreement ultimately cost Kevin McCarthy his job. Now, fast forward to today, next year's government funding bill could see another contentious battle.
How much does it cost to fund the United States government next year? Congressional Republicans released their top-line number, $1.6 trillion. The GOP plan includes defense increases of nearly $9 billion, Homeland Security funded above the president's budget request, fully funded Veterans Affairs, including veterans medical care and benefits, and cutting State Department funding by 11%. Overall, non-defense programs would see a 6% cut across the board. Democrats say no way.
They are cutting $75 billion out of non-defense discretionary funding, which will hurt children, hurt working families, hurt the ability to administer Social Security.
Republicans say the world has changed since last year, with wars everywhere, and increasing defense funding should be a top priority.
Senator Murray has said once again she's going to insist on equal treatment for defense and non-defense. That, in my view, is absurd. It doesn't reflect current needs.
Republicans plan to make cuts through the reconciliation process. The procedure overrides the Senate filibuster rules, which may otherwise require a 60-vote majority to pass.
The budget reconciliation process is a big part of the plan. We've made no secret about that. We want to be very aggressive. We want to cut taxes, cut regulations, and achieve real policy victories for the American people, and we think the reconciliation process is part of that.
But there is infighting within the GOP. Some Republicans want to wait until January after the election for President Trump, if he wins, to decide the best way to move forward. So where is this all leading?
Three MAGA Republicans are marching us to a government shutdown.
As of today, House Republicans have passed about 60% of next year's budget. House Speaker Mike Johnson wants to wrap up the rest of it by the August break, but that could be tough. Fights over the remaining appropriation measures are expected. And over in the Senate, House Democrats have already said that the GOP pass bills are dead on arrival. So time will tell if we're going to see the threat of yet another government shutdown. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including horror in India. Dozens of people are dead following a massive stampede. We have the latest. And ultra-Orthodox Jewish men clash with police in Israel. We'll tell you more. Welcome back. More than 100 people are dead and dozens others injured following a stampede at a religious gathering in northern India. Attendees at the Hindu event had rushed to leave a makeshift tent. Authorities say heat and suffocation could have led to the rush. Reports say more than 15,000 people gathered for the event and officials only had room for around 5,000. Prime Minister Narendra Modi offered his condolences to the families of the dead and was working to make sure the injured received help. Well, dozens of people in Pakistan rallied against the recent death sentence of a Christian man. The protesters from the country's minority community chanted, "Let Christians live." This after a Christian man was found guilty of blasphemy for sharing social media posts that were ruled to be hate speech against Muslims. Attorneys are set to appeal the death sentence. Thousands of ultra-Orthodox men clash with police in central Jerusalem. This after Israel's highest court issued an order for them to begin enlisting for military service. Military service is mandatory for most Jewish men and women in Israel. Politically powerful ultra-Orthodox parties want exemptions for their followers to skip military service. Instead, they study in religious seminaries. And joining us now to talk more about all of this is Rabbi Yaakov Menken, Managing Director of the Coalition for Jewish Values. Rabbi Menken, great to be with you again. A lot to unpack, but for those who may not know, tell us why military service is compulsory in Israel and why the ultra-Orthodox community had been exempt from it up until now.
Well, thanks so much for having me back. And obviously a divinity exemption for those engaged in religious studies is a normal thing that was part of the draft in the United States. Israel is, of course, faced with existential threats. It is being consistently attacked by very hostile forces that would not only eradicate the country, but eradicate all the Jews who live within it. So there really is a demand, and legitimate demand, that every Jewish person should contribute to that common defense. The real reason for the conflict, and this has begun with the beginning of the state, is that there were religious scholars studying Judaism in Israel, of course, long before there was a country. And we honestly, sincerely believe, as an article of faith, that religious studies offer their own protection, that people are actually protected from harm because people are engaged in these studies. And so from the religious community, the belief is that to take these students out of their religious studies and put them in the army would actually harm the defense of the country, not enhance it. And that's exactly why they are opposing it.
Yeah, and tell us a little bit more about how it could affect this community's lifestyle.
Well, you see, there's a legitimate clash there between two perspectives. One is, of course, a secular community that does not believe that religious studies have that same value, and they want to see the religious people participate in the defense, participate in the army. And there are actually plenty of soldiers from Haredi backgrounds, including many who are still Orthodox and observant, but yet a lot of people within the community, people don't understand the diversity of thought and opinion, the same way as in the Catholic Church. There's different rituals and different rites. Because the Jewish community is so built upon religious practices, there's different standards of kosher, there's different times for ending the Sabbath, etc. There's a very great deal of things to accommodate, such that the defense minister himself said that quotas in this case are actually very harmful, a very bad idea, because the army is not prepared to bring in the numbers that the Supreme Court has now announced it must. The IDF is simply not prepared to handle those numbers. So actually, from a practical perspective, this is really a non-starter.
Yeah, and obviously, I mean, this is causing a lot of uproar in Israel. What would happen to those that don't comply?
Well, you know, obviously they're threatening actual jail time. And there may be students who will be willing to be jailed rather than go into the army because, again, when it's a matter of sincere belief, and you see from the gleeful reactions here, from the fact that the ultra-left, unelected Supreme Court made a decision like this, specifically overriding the government's concerns, overriding the defense minister, and the tenor, again, of the articles that have been written since, that really what they're trying to do is attack and denigrate the Orthodox lifestyle and the fact that they do believe Torah study is of such great value. So they've turned it from a situation of a legitimate dispute over what is best for the country to a unprovoked, deliberate attack on the religious community as if Israel didn't have enough wars going on right now. So it's kind of obvious that the Haredi community faced like a threat like that will not comply.
All right, we have to leave it right there. Rabbi Menken, always good to be with you. Thank you so much for your insights.
Thank you.
All right, now to the war in Ukraine. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the U.S. will announce an additional $2.3 billion in security assistance for Ukraine. He made those remarks during a meeting with the Ukrainian defense minister at the Pentagon. And in Kyiv, President Volodymyr Zelensky met with Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. The visit was a rare gesture in a tense relationship between the two countries. Up next on EWTN News Nightly, next stop, sainthood. Learn more about the soon-to-be first millennial saint. Church leaders in Iowa are applauding a recent decision by the state's Supreme Court. The justices allowed a pro-life heartbeat law to take effect. This after they ruled that abortion is not a fundamental right in Iowa's Constitution. Iowa's bishops celebrated the ruling, saying in part, quote, "This is a question of the common good and human dignity. Human life is precious and should be protected in our laws to the greatest extent possible." Despite his short life, Carlo Acutis left a formidable legacy and lasting impact on many for his immense love for Jesus and use of technology for the glory of God. The Vatican has now officially approved his canonization as well as that of 14 other blesseds. Anthony Johnson from the EWTN Vatican Bureau has more.
During his life, Blessed Carlo Acutis was a computer coding teenager, but in death, he is the first millennial saint to be. Known for his devotion to Marian apparitions and Eucharistic miracles, he cataloged all of them on a website he designed. His mother says she knew her son will be canonized.
I'm not surprised because a few months after he died, he told me, "Mama, I will in my dreams." He appeared to me in my dreams, and he said, "Mama, I will be beatified, and then I will be canonized." So I was already prepared.
Only 10 days after his diagnosis, Acutis died of a rare type of leukemia at the young age of 15. Despite the rapid progression of his illness and the fact he knew the end was near, the young boy showed a supernatural peace and readiness for death.
For Carlo, death was the passage through the through life. And for Carlo, his love was Jesus. So when you die, you meet Jesus. The only thing he used to say that we have to live like if each day of our life is the last day of our life. Mm. And he said that Carlo used to say that the only things we have to be scared is sin, because this can take us away for the eternity from Jesus.
Blessed Carlo made many pilgrimages to Assisi in Italy, and that is where his mortal remains rest. So it was fitting that Pope Francis chose the place as the site of the Millennials' beatification, just 2 days shy of the 14th anniversary of Acutis' death. Since the day of his passing, thousands of people have come to pray for his intercession at his grave.
And we are very happy because we see that Carlo is doing a lot of good people, and each year, each day, we receive a news of a possible miracle, healings, conversion, people that couldn't have the son or then became pregnant, or people that had no works, many different type of, especially healings, you know, and conversion. This is the most important for me, because eternal life is the most important thing.
While Acutis' canonization date has not been set, it is expected sometime during the 2025 Jubilee. On October 20th, the 14 other Blesseds will be canonized. They include Italian and Canadian founders of religious orders, as well as the 11 Martyrs of Damascus, who refused to renounce their Christian faith and convert to Islam during the 1860 Syrian Civil War. In Rome, Anthony Johnson, EWTN News Nightly.
And we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night, and God bless.